2014 will go down as the warmest year around the globe in recorded history.
2015 was the hottest year since climate records began.
Your show this July was the single hottest month in recorded history.
Australia sweltered through its hottest spring on record.
Climate change is now affecting every country on every continent.
The rate is a great concern.
And what do you put that rate down to?
Oh, it's human activity.
We have everything we need. Some still doubt that we have the will to act, but I say the will to act is itself a renewable resource.
Hello and welcome to Climactic. The following interview by host Beth Spencer with poet and artist Kit Kalin was recorded for Climactic just after this summer's bushfire crisis, but before the pandemic crisis. And during, of course, the ongoing climate crisis. I hope you enjoyed this wide-ranging discussion about creative practice, poetry, art, habits, doodling, the power of humor and disruption, the value of friendship, and the importance of community. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Climactic, Stories from the Climate Community, an art breaker where we talk about creativity in a time of climate crisis. My name is Beth Spencer and my guest today is a poet and painter. He's published a dozen full-length collections in English as well as translated books of poetry in numerous languages. He has been shortlisted and won various prizes. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Macau, where he taught for many years. He's a conjoint professor at the University of Newcastle, and he's a fellow of the Royal Society of New South Wales. And he's just incredibly prolific across such a range of practices and forms that I wanted to have him on to talk to us today. He's an editor, a mentor, a publisher, a blogger, a world traveller. Hello, Kit Kalin. Welcome to Climactic.
G'day, Beth.
Now, out of all the thousands of poems that we could choose, I've chosen for you to start with reading the title poem from a book called Republic, which is from quite a few years ago, because there's a story behind this, that this is how we actually met through that poem. Because I had a small job for ABC Radio National many years ago, where I was asked to select a piece of writing for the New Poets segment. And when they gave me this job, they handed me a folder full of bits and pieces. And I was flipping through it, and I started reading this poem. And I just thought, wow, I have to hear this read aloud. So can we hear some of this, please?
Okay. Yeah, and just to clarify, the poem's called Republic, but the book it was in is called Republics, which has like lots of different versions. And it was published around the time of the referendum, which was a great disappointment. Anyway, the poem... The villages are wished away, and the kingdom of 6 o'clock closing. Shall I invoke you as an ultimatum, threat or promise, secret republic declared long ago, oracular republic of shillings and pence, of bush week, of whims assembled to towns strung on tracks till the tar melts in summer, republic of the burning bush and the sand blows over us, crusts all our dreams, shark-infested floater, sand-ringed, bright in a fly-blown, shielding-the-eyes sort of way. Republic of oldest curses, latest luck, of shopkeepers smug in wise saws, free with advice but tight with their credit, postmasters weighing and measuring doom, profitless waste of quids to be made. Survivor's Republic, lost causes, found comforts, of great good fortune talked itself down to dust, of greater regrets, Republic of ought-to-be, smog, grim defiance, of the empty gesture, the endless beach, of the sun never setting, the clock runneth over, the wake waves break forever, Republic of terrible skies and taller than others, of the world's bluest ocean, of all colours cancelled, dragging through court by the office of jealousy, its new tax on everyone's everyday spark for good measure, Republic of the fair go, empty republic thought up by pisspots and murdering bastards, of loud writing, of scribbled bark smaller than hands, of the roaring deaf torn to fists in the pub of the serious business, terra nullius and the broken jukebox, republic of the old truths hidden, of never, never say you're sorry, deliver the same blows again, republic of uncontrollable nights, thighs danced till dawn without fear or favour or memory either, of the world's weary pause come to rest here at last, of the happy-go-lucky sat up like Jackie, jungle republic of crocodiles waiting, sharks in the shallows, stripped assets and staff sent home, republic of gullet, of gulping it down, of half-pissed regrets for same follies repeated, republic of not knowing how it got home, or forgetting to go, or wherever it came from. Republic of strangers trying to please, of refugees sprayed on arrival, of burning the boats, and they still wash ashore. Banana republic, uranium glow, anorexic, bulimic, mumbling excuses, beery republic with its balls on the barbie, of the borrowed aphorism, of we told you so, of having your own way, us and them in the convict republic, of the past, of the few, of doing to others what they've done to you, republic lit on the hill of redistribution, of the lost agenda, of stumbling in mood swings, monster republic, and six heads can't agree, the wedge's thin edge and the floodgates of peril, of two wongs and a horde of whites, of the class and of the gender, of the great forms fallen into disuse, of magazine royals, involuntary intrigue, of service disgruntled, of dreamy afflictions, of not yet, till it's knighted itself for services rendered, republic of garments sewn up in abjection, shoes healed thereto, of nothing is mended, republic of Tories who take the horizon, having their effortless way with all labour, big baby republic of lottery winners, sniffs its own flesh in the fire it's still building, surly republic, grudging the chore of choosing its stupor, you Butte republic of having your cake, eating it too, boys' own pack-rape republic, of the weak applause, of the wild jeering, the frenzied bid, of diggers, of dim regrets, lunch in the trenches, head in the sand, hangdog mouth, chips on both shoulders, lording the penguins, in love with its clichés of distance, of dullness, shiny republic, of suits and ties, trading the future forever for dinner today, of the union gone blue in its shivery underwear, disintegrated communists who won the big battle, of flash ideas condemned to slow death, sold overseas for want of cash, for another cask of our own Chardonnay. There's plenty more, but we'll stop there.
That's great. I love this because it just draws on so many of the concerns and stylistic tricks that I enjoy so much in your poetry. And it's such a great commentary on the whole post-colonial Australian culture and ideas about what create us as a people and so on.
I was just going to say, interesting echo there for me. The poem I've been writing this morning is about Holden. It's Weep for Holden. And I've got that trope there again about, you know, being so pissed you don't know how you got home, which was, in my childhood, a thing that one heard commonly said.
And we didn't even have seatbelts in those days too. Yeah, different time. So it really goes through this sweep of history before your childhood, in your childhood, right through. And it still reads so potent right now. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what led you to write a book called Republics.
Oh, well, it was in the lead up to the referendum, which, you know, Howard arranged for his own purposes.
And this is in 1999.
Yeah. And there was a movement about the Republic. And I'd written that poem 5 or 6 years earlier. And I started gathering things on that theme. It was also at that time that I'd started really working on nation and nationalism from a scholarly point of view, and particularly focused on anthems. You know, national anthems has been a major scholarly interest of mine over a long time. So the whole idea of, call it anthem quality, which I think that poem is about really, you know, what is conjured up by Australian national ethos, patriotism, those things? What are they about? I've always been interested in that. And dispossession, you know, as a theme as well, you know, the lies that are at the centre of Australian self-consciousness or Australian unconsciousness, maybe I should say.
Yeah, it's that idea of how we create ourselves as a people through stories and language and tales and ideas and little fragments of conversation. I think it just does that so well. You've moved around, you've travelled, you've lived in Macau for many, many years. You've travelled just about everywhere and been translated everywhere. And
not really, but no.
But, well, an awful lot of places. And you've even got an honorary doctorate in Sweden, is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
The University of Malmö.
Yeah. And so in some ways, all the world is your world. But in other ways, you've got a very special place at the Myall Lakes at Markwell. And one of your books, Scavenger's Season, I feel like it's like a love song to that place and the history of it and the complexity of it and your relationship with it and also your relationship with your partner, Carol, who's also an artist. So what is home for you?
Yeah. Home is there, definitely. We got that place in the late 80s and we built our house there in 93. And when you've spent a long time away from it working elsewhere, you know, I've been in East Asia for 20-something years over the last 30 years, but always coming back to Australia. So I think you retain a strong sense of home in that sense. You know, the meditation that you give yourself when it's hard to get to sleep because of whatever's happening at work or whatever, and you imagine yourself walking around the place. You know what I mean? Walking around a 5-acre bush block. And, yeah, I'm working on manuscripts now that are largely based on experience of weather and seasons and things there. Absolutely. But I was just going to say on the point about nation and the cosmopolitan and the local. Yeah, I mean, my interest is in the local and the global. And I think nation and nationalism is a huge and terrible distraction from that. But, you know, in particular when it comes to, well, put it this way. Since empires, so-called, faded out towards the end of the 19th century into the early 20th century, the deadliest abstraction on the earth today is definitely nation. You can blame multinationals for all sorts of things, but the weapons are all owned by nations. It's the nations that are killing people. And, you know, all the nuclear weapons are owned by nations. So if that Armageddon comes our way, it will be because of national conflict.
And these nations, which are bolstered by these myths and language and ideas of ourselves, and as you say, the Australian consciousness or unconsciousness.
Yeah, it's not so benign. So when I look at, just to shift frames, when I look at Australian poetry, it kind of annoys me that so much of it, because of the way funding works, because of the way publishing works, because of where universities are, et cetera, that so much of poetry should be conducted on a national basis seems to me, it's appalling. And that's why I'm so interested in translation, you know, in getting myself translated into other languages, but also in translating and publishing other poets, particularly in a bilingual format. Because I think poetry really is a cosmopolitan thing, but it should be something connected with where you are, with where everyone is.
And that, I guess, the translation then makes you even more aware of the specificity of language.
Absolutely.
And so on. So it's a wonderful combination, that kind of very global kind of consciousness and that very, very local at the same time.
Well, the thing for poets about translation, and you know this because I've, well, we know this together, yeah, because I organised your translation into Chinese. But
I should just declare my, not only have I known Kit since I read that poem, which is, must be 25 years now, but also he invited me to be part of the Flying Islands, this beautiful series of books that he does where he pairs an Australian poet with a Chinese translator, often one of your master's students, wasn't it?
Look, a range of people, and it's certainly not only Chinese.
Sorry,
and
it's true.
And it's often not one translator, it's often a team. And also, we did it with you long before Flying Islands books happened. You were in one of the groups we workshopped with at Bundanon, which was before that.
So,
I mean, the point I was trying to make is that the great thing about translators for poets is that they're your best possible reader. If they're serious, they're the closest reader you'll ever get. They take you really seriously. And I've workshopped with many, many poets with translators, and one of the most amusing things is how poets can be suspicious of them, and I've had to take a number of Australian poets aside and say, these guys are not critics. Whatever you want to mean, that's what they want to mean. They're on your side. So
and let the poem go. And yeah.
Yeah, and people discover all sorts of things about their work that they hadn't known through the translation workshopping process. Because you know, when you're a native speaker writing for native speakers, a lot of what you're doing is very unconscious, and you speak to a translator about it who's not a native speaker, and you need to make things explicit. And in that process, well, a lot of people end up revising their original poems as a result of the process, which is, I don't think, a bad thing at all.
No, I've found it an absolutely magical experience. You're very instinctive in who you pair people with too, and you paired me with Iris Phan and Ruby Chen, and they were both just so wonderful. And I just want to say, one of your roles that is so admirable and I love is just how many poets you have helped along the way and got going again, or got them expanding their poetry or their first books. And for me, that Bundanon, I'm glad you mentioned about that. I was living in the van at the time, the camper van, and you said, oh, you know, you don't need accommodation, so why don't you come and we'll bring you into this program. And that actually got me back into writing poetry, because that we were using poems that I'd written, I don't know how many years before that, before I made a diversion into fiction. And just being around poets and Iris's response to a poem that I'd, you know, someone from a completely different generation, a completely different culture, responded so strongly to something I'd written when I was the same age as her, just was so moving. And it was just such a wonderful experience.
And I think the thing about Iris, of course, who's by the way, just had her first baby in New York.
Oh, I did not know that.
And she finished her PhD, I think a year or two ago now. But anyway, the great thing about Iris is that she's really a great poet and a great bilingual poet, who's doing really interesting out-of-the-box things with self-translation.
Ah, yes, and she did her PhD in WA.
UWA.
And I've got some of her books on my shelf. So there's just so many conversations basically going on that you seem to be initiating and involved in, and pairing people up and creating stuff and putting it out and then starting another lot. Where do you get the time for all this? How do you... Do you find that creativity begets creativity?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of it's habit, and you know, you have bad habits and good habits, or habits that don't fall into those categories. But, I mean, look, people ask me, how can you get up and write a poem every morning? And I have to say, having done this for, well, if you look at Project 366, I don't know if we were going to cover this or not.
Yeah, but we will. They can talk a couple of it now if you like. Project 366, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is a project that started on the 1st of January 2016, and the idea was to get a bunch of poets and fellow travellers, so to create a poetry-centric community of practice online where people would post draft works every day. And there were some people signing up for the year, some people signing up for the month, and it was supposed to go for a year. And at the end of the year, a whole lot of people had missed days and not finished, and so I agreed to keep going with them so that people would get to their 366. And then one thing led to another, and it went for 4 years, and we finally called it off before the new leap year started at the end of December last year. So that's, from my point of view, that was 1,450 drafts, you know, each day for those 4 years. So what I was going to say was, people ask me, how can you do it every morning? And I have to honestly say, it would be much harder not to do it. And in fact, when I get into a situation traveling or whatever, where it's hard for me to produce a poem, a draft in the morning, I find it very frustrating. So, you know, it's habit.
That's interesting. So rather than having only doing poetry when you have a holiday or once a year or on a fellowship, you find that habit of doing it daily actually makes it easier to do it.
Well, it also makes you better at it.
Yeah.
Practice. I mean, poets are people who write poems, aren't they? They're not people who just ponce about because they wrote a poem 20 years ago and it got published somewhere nice. You know, if you're a poet, you produce the stuff.
It reminds me of this interesting study I heard about two groups of artists, potters, and one group was told to spend the next 10 weeks making a fantastic pot for an exhibition. And the other group was told, just make as many pots as you can.
Mm.
And at the end of the 10 weeks, the ones that were told, just make as many pots as you can, actually produced...
better pots.
Better pots, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, a lot of it's to do with personality and, you know, aptitude and whatever. And there are huge differences that way. If you think about Stephen Spender's essay he wrote in the 1950s called The Making of a Poem, where he talks about all these extremes of creative effort being defined as the Beethoven method and the Mozart method. What it's about is that everything that Mozart created was holistic, based on a complete form, a conception from the beginning and details filled out. And when musicologists looked at Beethoven's notes later on, they couldn't understand it because it was exactly the opposite, that he was essentially working from fragments, leitmotifs, whatever, and weaving them all together into a unity. So two completely different ways of working. And it's not the case that everybody works one way or the other. You could change through your life from one to the other. You could challenge yourself because your proclivity is for one, but it's an interesting way to go the other way. You know, whatever. I just think it's interesting to conceive of these differences in the way people approach effort. But from my point of view, I think the enemy of artistic production, and particularly the enemy of artistic community, is preciousness. And it's a bit like that cliche about the perfect being the enemy of the good, but thinking that you're creating this precious object and it must be perfectly finished, I mean, where's that going to get you?
Yes. Can I get you to read, while we're on the subject of making things, the poem To Tend?
Ah, yes.
Page 91 in the Pocket the Kit, I think.
Pocket Kit 2.
Pocket Kit 2.
To tend the gods as given, as found, new habits of homage are required, in word untamed, in sight unframed, paths to follow are so chosen, by you, for you, willing, blind. Go to the makers, not to the mockers. Take the trouble to tell them apart. Dust of the world you're sleeping off, lonely under feats of self, but work outlasts if you stay with the tune, survives you and the all that wearied, mockers, thieves, and smug ignorers. In the end, they scale away. So get the toxins out of your system. Protect yourself. Protect your spark. Light in the eyes may be derided. Spring in the step, its menace is met. But you, brave maker, face the dark without within. For you, the tale untold doffs cap, the wheels take on their fated spin. If you'll remember one injunction, go to the makers, never the mockers. Tend to the habits of homage you've found.
I love that poem, go to the makers, not the mockers. I think that's a great slogan.
And it's had so many versions. And every time I look at a poem, I wish to revise it, which
and you
really
do.
Pisses translators off because they think they've translated something.
Oh, the authentic, which is the authoritative poem.
Yeah, so I mean, I often tell, in fact, I did it this morning with my, I'm doing this book for a Greek publisher in Athens, and I wrote to my Greek translator and said, look, I'm sure I'll keep playing with these, but from your point of view, this is good enough, you know?
Yep.
Anything I play with will be close enough to what you translate to not embarrass you.
I should just say some of the languages you've been translated into is Chinese, Portuguese, French, Italian, Spanish, Indonesian, Swedish, Norwegian, and Filipino.
Yeah, I just gave you my new book that's in two Filipino languages, in Tagalog and Kampampangan.
I just want to go back to when we're looking, talking about Markwell and the Mar Lakes region. So we've just been through an incredibly brutal summer. I think for a lot of people, we knew a lot was changing. We knew it was coming, but New Year's Eve kind of was just a real wake up and a shock. What was it like for you living in the bush with a house that you'd built and conceived of and loved for all those years? with fires all around, practically the whole country burning.
Yeah, well, it's very confronting. And we had, you know, fires 6 km north of us at one point and fires 8 km south of us at another point. And we had the car packed ready to go quite a lot of the time. And we got the firefighter pump and a lesson in how to use it. And it's very confronting, and it's, incredibly disappointing that we have a government that's basically in the pocket of the fossil fuel lobbies, a prime minister whose office is full of coal people, one way or another, coming or going, and Murdoch people, which is just as bad. All these climate change denialists, hard, soft, in between, whatever version of it you like, they're really holding us back from having a better society. I mean, you've kind of got me going now. But, I mean, I've been writing a lot about this, which I discovered when this Greek publisher, they already had a manuscript and they'd been noticing all this stuff about the fires and said, well, what have you got on the fire? So I started going through my drafts to put them all in one folder and discovered that I had a book-length manuscript on the subject of the drought and the fires. But, I think one of the arguments to take to the denialists is that Australian coal kills people all over the world. If there was no climate change at all, if you didn't have to worry about that, Australia makes up 40% of the world's coal export market. So if you look at WHO figures on deaths from air pollution annually, it's very hard to determine because, you know, people are very sick and then they die and what was the cause of their death. But the low estimates are around 4 to 5 million people worldwide a year, and the high estimates are around 7 to 8 million people dying from air pollution. Mm-hmm. If you look at what proportion of that is made up from Australian coal, a very, very conservative estimate would say that Australian coal is killing 100,000 people every year. Now, that's a figure that's roughly equivalent to the road toll in China or the toll from industrial accidents in China. So if there were no global warming, there'd be a serious reason to stop exporting coal to the world from Australia.
Exporting death and also dispossessing indigenous people from their lands and,
all sorts of shit. And what proportion of the workforce is it? If you ask your average Australian, they think it's a lot. Actually, it's 38,000 people totally involved in the coal industry, which is very mechanised, 1.6% of the Australian workforce, according to the 2017 figures. Mm-hmm. But if you look at entertainment and the arts, it's 2%.
Yeah.
You know, education is like 7 or 8%. Health is 12%. So, I mean, 1.6% of people who basically should be involved in solar panels and wind farms. While we're on facts and figures here, the other thing, this widely cited figure, Australia's part in global emissions is 1.3% or something, which already makes us one of the top three per capita emitters. Okay, but that's a rubbish figure because it doesn't take into account our coal exports, which would bring us up to at least 5%, maybe 6 or 7%, therefore making us easily the world's worst per capita. And it does not take into account this last summer, where on top of our normal emissions, we've added 70% of that through bushfire smoke. But of course, that doesn't count because we didn't mean it.
Yeah.
We weren't intending to do that. I mean, all of this
weaselly... We didn't make any money from it.
Yeah, we didn't make any money out of it, so it doesn't count. So there really needs to be a serious shift in government. And the fact that the Labor Party entertains all this love of coal along with the coalition is, it's very disappointing. And it needs to be, people need to be out on the streets and writing to their local members and doing everything they can. And I think writing poetry is and singing songs and painting pictures is part of all of that.
Can I get you to read another poem?
Yeah, sure.
Speaking of it, talking about good old rants, a good thing to have.
there's the rant inside the poem and the rant beyond it. Go on.
The rants. Got to have rants. If we read one from Scavengers? Uh-huh. Scavengers Season in Creek Beds?
Okay. Hoof and snout and paw have speech in last year's grass drought yellow. love that the path turns by its will, and I have trod that way in coming. Some skies suggest a rainbow. Birds bank and spin till out of day. The clouds wheel low. Love that the creek turns by its will, where sky came tumbling all to level. That the stones have smoothed to fit the foot, and I have trod that way.
I love that sense of that this is a place that you have trod and known, and that it fits you and you fit it, and just that beautiful relationship backwards and forwards. It's all through that book. And
yeah, it took an amazingly long time to write, I have to say.
Did it? For you?
Yeah, I mean, the ridiculous amount of revising, actually. Yeah, it's like 25 years, basically.
Well, it really was a work of love in so many ways. And you've done work with, you've done exhibitions and so on with your partner, Carol.
Yeah, we've had, that's a kind of complicated history. I think I've had about 10 solo exhibitions in different parts of the world, and Carol will as well. And then together, we've had a number of exhibitions that were both our painting, but also we've had shows where it was my poetry with her artwork. So that's what Time with the Sky was, for instance. That was work that came out of Abundant on Residency in 08 or 09, somewhere around there.
And we're talking about Carol Archer,
Dr. Carol Archer, who's an Australian
artist who also lived many years in Macau with you. Is that right?
Well, she lived more in Hong Kong, actually. She was teaching at Ling Nam University for many years, and I was at the University of Macau.
How do you find sort of juggling each other's creativity? Does it mean that you both become more creative?
We think of
artists and writers as these terribly temperamental people who can get moody and all that kind of thing. And you get two together, do they clash or do they just feed and nourish each other? Or both?
Who knows? I don't know if I should speak publicly about such things. I'm sure we're always inspiring each other.
Did you get into painting through Carol?
To us, it's very important to have very separate workspaces, for instance, because we have very different aesthetics that you know cross over at certain points. Mm. But you've got to have your own space and you know frame to work in. Sure. What was the other question?
Did you start painting after Carol?
I've only been painting for about 15 years or something. Carol's been a painter, visual artist. I mean, not just her whole adult life. She was, as a child, I was into poetry from an early age, and I think she was into art from an early age. You know, I got into art actually from doodling in meetings and conferences.
I remember
and
your doodle blog that you had about 20 years ago. You had a whole blog about doodling.
Yeah, you can still find that. Yeah, I remember you saying to me at a conference, you were watching me doodle, and then I asked a question.
Yes.
And you said to me, how could you have done, and you know, how were you able to ask a question that was relevance when
and I have to just say here to people that I'm not talking about him just doing little doodles in the corner or something like that. He was creating this beautiful work while someone was giving a talk, and I'm sort of nodding off because it was a hot afternoon, and he was also bringing out his watercolors and he was coloring it in and he was doing all these intricate things, and then they asked for questions and suddenly he put up his hand and asked this incredibly beautifully formulated question.
And you inspired me to look at the research on this, which actually shows that people who doodle in meetings are much better focused than people who are trying to concentrate. Because if you try to concentrate, you're just going to think about the shopping or whatever. And in fact, because then you're not controlling the other place that your mind goes to.
Which is great, and it's part of, again, what seems to be coming out of this, is that the more creativity inspires more creativity, and that conversation between all the different aspects of it. So what, for you, is the difference between when you go to make a painting and when you go to make a poem? Is there a different process?
Whoa, can I pause that question for a moment and just say, I think that the thing that creativity c- can often depend on, and I think doodling in the conference is a good example, is this thing Michel Desserteaux calls the peruk, which is time stolen from official consciousness.
Mm.
Okay, that might sound a bit weird, but what it means is, so the secretary writing love letters in the moments she finds to do it at her desk, or the carpenter who, with the scraps of wood off the floor, makes a toy for his child at home. These are Desserteaux's examples. But I think anyone who's got a creative practice who holds down a day job is involved in some kind of peruk, stealing time for one thing for another. Now, if your job is the creative practice, that becomes a bit tricky. I mean, if you're retired from the day job and you're just doing creative stuff, then you've only got yourself from whom to steal time. Well, I think you can make that work by having more than one practice, basically. And that's kind of what I'm doing. It's interesting, just going back to, you know, there was a stage with the doodling before you saw the effort where it was just in pen on paper, and somebody leaned over to me at a conference or in a meeting and said to me, why don't you try colour? That could be interesting. And then I did. And you feel a bit self-conscious taking coloured pencils to a conference at first, but then what the hell? Why not? So I think being able to shift from one thing to another, from one mode to another, it's a little bit like, you know, left brain, right brain stuff.
I think we should be handing out paper and pens at the next conference.
Yeah, well, the way they say, you know, pianists have this, you know, more balanced brain because of what the left hand and the right hand both have to produce notes that go together. You know, it's different from what a guitarist is doing, for instance.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of guitar, when I was pulling books off my shelves that you either wrote or edited or co-edited or initiated in some form.
Books that are my fault. I know what you're saying, Beth.
Books that you had a finger in as well. And there was quite a pile I was collecting. I also found a CD of your playing guitar called Two Guitars the Same that you sent me many years ago. So just let listeners know that beg your pardon, don't worry about the cover, they don't have to see that, but we will be threading some of music from Two Guitars the Same by Kit Kellen through this. So we really have covering a lot of cross arts practices here. Has being translated changed the way you write and how you see yourself as a poet?
Mm. Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of what I write self-consciously for translation and thinking about actually particular languages into which things will go and thinking of particular translators with whom I work and thinking about explanations I'm going to have to make. I notice on the table here in front of me, you've got a copy of Notes for the Translators, and this is a book. I edited about 10 years ago, which was after having done a lot of workshops with people, we thought it would be a good idea to ask a whole lot of Australian poets and New Zealand poets to throw us one poem each with their notes on what they think a translator ought to pay attention to in looking at that poem. The idea being that with that, a translator could create an anthology of Australian poet or Australasian poetry in any language, and it's been used by a lot of people since then.
It's also just a fabulous book to read because you read a poem and then you read each person's got like a little essay in whichever way they wanted to put it beside that. So it's a terrific way to construct a book.
And also to make people think about how a non-native of English could understand their work well enough to create a version of it that would communicate with the native speakers of their language. I think that's a great challenge for poetry. And I think it's the sort of thing that poetry's for. You know, there's all that stuff, famous misquote of Robert Frost about poetry being untranslatable. Well, yes, it's true that poetry's lost in translation, but it's also found, in the process of translation. I think it's a really important training for poets to try to translate or co-translate. I mean, I'm not good enough at any language other than English to translate by myself. I only co-translate with other people. But I think I've become fairly adept at facilitating the process into English from various languages and at getting people to ask the right questions to go into other languages from English.
I remember that book because you invited me to put a poem in and I couldn't work out what to do, but I knew that Iris had chosen one of mine called Poem for Jessie to translate at Bundanon, and so I put that in and I was so shocked that she chose that because it's got things like Matt's Blue Room in Fitzroy and it's Evie Parts 1 and 2, which, you know,
Highly specific
to a generation and a place and a culture, and yet she chose that. So something in that.
She's a bit of a groover, Iris. Are you listening? But it's that too. But it's also, I think some translators are really attracted to the culturally specific and temporally specific material because they like that challenge of recreating a setting.
Well, Ruby chose some as well, one that mentioned the Brady Bunch. And when someone read that in Mandarin at my launch, I said, how did you, like, you know, get that? And she said, oh, I just like the sound of the words.
Yeah, well, that's another way they go to. Look, I remember in early noughties, I went to the first, in Chengdu, in Sichuan, the first Chinese conference on the beat poets, on beat poetics, which was really a blast. And the first approaches to beat poetic in China were to do with it all being disgusting and reprehensible and deviant behaviours. And then there were other approaches later by the time this conference happened. But, yeah, I guess translators choose what they want to engage with and publishers too. There's a lot of filters between any two languages of poetry, I suppose, and that's an interesting study in itself. But when you're from one culture and you've got the opportunity to introduce people to guide another readership into poetry, I mean, what I've always tried to do with Australian poetry is to make it as broad a church as possible, you know, to give people as many different, I mean, I've always liked to create anthologies where I put together between covers people who would rather not be in the same room if they could avoid it.
And in the series as well. So how many books in the Flying Islands pocketbooks now?
There's 70 books and there's 7 or 8 on the drawing board for this year and then there's a few in the offing for next year as well. So, yeah, I mean, we're averaging 5 to 10 a year, I guess. And probably a third of those are bilingual. You know, we've had Chinese, Portuguese, Spanish, Lithuanian, Swedish, Norwegian, you know, a few other languages, Tagalog, Maori. So the more languages, the better as far as I'm concerned.
And it makes a beautiful book too, because it's like little artworks when you see it, particularly with the Mandarin, and you've got one page in English and the facing page is in Mandarin. It's beautiful, and it gives that space in between pausing with the pages. I just think it's a fabulous project that's worked so well.
Well, thank you. I hope it continues. I hope it continues to be funded, and I hope if anyone's interested in helping design, we need more designers. Get in touch.
Well, and they're beautiful looking too, all of the covers. You've managed to come up with a style that allows each poet to select, with your input, a really striking image. And then it's got this beautiful clean white type around it and the photo on the back. So you get this very strong series of text at the same time as each one is just an individual little work of art.
Yeah, it's nice lining them up with all the author picks on the back, because we don't, and I should stress to the people who might be interested in the designing that nobody gets paid. This is community
publishing. This is all
publishing.
Love, yes.
So just pointing that out. But yeah, it's nice when you line up the backs of the books and you can see all the author picks. We don't have any Enconia on the, you know, praise words on the back covers. We just have a picture of the author and the logos.
Yeah, it's strong and simple, and it creates that very strong series and that individual, which I guess is what you're doing in all sorts of ways. So your latest, you've moved on from 366 now to a blog called The Daily Kit, which is at the Daily Kit /blogspot.com, if someone wants to have a look at it.
Yep.
And in this one, it's that similar sort of thing about process. And so I noticed that you include things like mind maps sometimes, like the little Where you,
ah, that's what you call them.
That's what I call them. Well, it's just like, instead of just like linear ideas about a draft of a poem, you've got, and I do the same thing, is you little ideas all over the page in different spots and how they connect up. And
but
draft
versions. You say it as if I'd planned this diabolically, but actually it's the notes from which the poem is written.
Exactly. And I do the same thing. You don't put the notes in a linear way. You put them in, they've got to be in...
I think it's interesting to show up
and odd little connections. You're looking for those odd connections and things.
Yeah, I mean, what I did with one of them was I tried to show like a time lapse thing, just show the same page in 20 shots. I can't remember which poem it is. Anyway, just 20 screenshots virtually of the page as the lines got added to, so you could sort of see how it progressed. And I thought I should do the same thing with a painting as well, to see how that goes. Because with painting, I reprime a lot. In other words, I get to a certain point, am disgusted, and splash paint over the whole thing and start again.
Start again.
But that allows you, that gives you something to scratch back into, which is interesting. So I've worked with these two painting methods, what I call scratch and flow, like paint that's flowing, oil and water sort of idea, and then the dried thing that you can scratch into with pens or knives, or you can really attack and take things out on a canvas. That's good. You can't really do that in a poem. I mean, you can shout, but it's not the same.
Well, I think revision is kind of sometimes like that. And it's interesting, too, that you said Scavenger's Season basically is written over 25 years, because I think we're always having our, not just conversation with other poems and other people in the culture, but we're also having a conversation with our own poetry at times, too. And you was said that there was a line that came up from Republic that you were using today in something. It's this constant process
home.
And backwards and forwards and creating new connections. And I think, the Daily Kit is a wonderful look at that. It reminds me of something. I was listening to a guy called Andy Pizza, who does Creative Pep Talk podcast, which is interesting and a little crazy at times. And he talked about the difference between breadcrumbs and bait. Uh-huh. And he said in the old days, the way we was meant to do it was when you made something, you're making bait. So you sit alone in a room and you craft it and you make it perfect and you make it fantastic and then you pop it out in the water and all the little fishies come to it. Uh-huh. Whereas he said now it's more about breadcrumbs. And that's exactly what you're doing with the Daily Kit, is this constant giving people that are interested in your process and insights into how you're working, as well as the actual product itself. It's not just about product, it's about the whole engagement and process and the conversations around it. So,
yeah, actually, I think the breadcrumbs are on Facebook now. But and there's
well, you've got breadcrumbs of breadcrumbs, yes. You
something
do.
Chunky you can go to if you visit the blog.
Little tiny, weeny crumbs, and then you've got the bigger breadcrumbs. But it's that generosity of not just giving out the final product, but giving out your process as well along the way and inviting people into it, which is a whole different way of being a poet, really.
Lots of convict toil, Australian as General Motors, by Paddock, Rust now gone, gone to a better place, with stockwhip, blanket and a Cobra, drunk so bloody much, don't know how we got home, maybe didn't, eat my dust, hit the road, weep for Holden, a sacred trust.
Weep for Holden. Yes, because we're actually conducting this interview 2 days after, or the day after?
The day after, yeah.
The day after it was announced that Holden is no more, and both of us, the first car I drove in as a little baby was a FJ Holden.
But you wouldn't have to be a genius to think that once they'd stopped making them in this country, that it was going to die. Anyway.
But to go back to our ranting before.
Sorry.
Well, no, but to go back to the whole thing about coal, the subsidies to coal to keep the coal industry going, and yet they couldn't give subsidies to the car industry, whereas the car industry, if you've got your own car industry, then you can bring in electric cars and you can design for the country and all that kind of stuff.
Ah, no, but no. Just, there is now a beautiful opportunity to start an electric car industry. I mean, it's a totally different thing. We start from scratch.
Oh, okay.
And this is what this is what Australia should be doing.
Okay, so Holden bites the dust and...
Holden bites the dust. General Motors, a multinational in Australia. They were all multinationals. Has there been an Australian car since the war, actually?
Well, apparently Adam Bandt's father designed the Ute.
Well, oh, I thought it was invented in Geelong in the 1920s. That famous song, Henry Ford. Henry got a letter from a farmer in Geelong saying the sheep don't fit where the family belong. They built the ute.
It could be one of those things like who taught Ron Barassi how to kick a football. A lot of people might claim to have invented the ute, but I just read that the other day, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, 1920s, I think. Ah. And I know that with a Model T, you could actually attach a plough to the back of it. I had some magazine that showed instructions for how your plough could be attached. Anyway, we digress again.
We are digressing, which is what poetry is. It's just a constantly digressing into things. And I'm going to interrupt us here to say that the ute was indeed designed by a family member of Adam Bandt, the leader of the Greens Party, and it was designed in Geelong in the 1930s in the Ford factory in response to a letter from a farmer. So we were both almost right. So do you want to talk a little bit about your next project?
Ataraxia, okay.
Ataraxia.
So ataraxia is the idea of kind of tranquility that a number of Greek philosophies of that generation, let's say, after Aristotle aspired to, but particularly in the philosophy of Epicurus. Plato's school was called the Academy, and Epicurus' school, also on the outskirts of Athens, was called the Garden. And the people who went there actually ate out of, you know, they tended the garden and that's what fed them, which is something I can't quite claim to be doing, although I love my garden. I'm certainly glad there's a supermarket to go to. But it's basically, I suppose, the idea about being in the here and now and making this constant effort to understand where you are and to be at peace with that, and to promote particularly the value of friendship and so community, which I think is, to me, what poetry is all about. It's about community and bettering the world through friendship, which is counter to lots of things in the way our societies, well, in the Trump and Morrison age, you know, where greed yes. seems to rule everything and where truth is
and they are profoundly anti-community times
yeah.
in every way.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I'm very interested in the way creative effort of every kind connects with community, enables community, and is enabled by community. Mm-hmm. And I think it's through creative effort we're going to turn the world from fossil fuels into something much better than that. And I'll just give you this analogy. Think about how cigarette advertising was stopped in Australia. I've just been in Germany working at the youth library in Munich for a chunk of last year, and they still have billboard advertising for cigarettes in Germany, and they have a lot more people
wow.
smoking there, and cigarettes are a lot cheaper there. Mm. And how was it stopped in Australia? Largely through the creative effort of an organisation called Bugger Up, billboard utilising graffitis
yes.
against unhealthy promotions, which a lot of people might not remember, but into the 70s and 80s, they made cigarette advertising a joke.
They did, and it was
derision.
A completely illegal guerrilla thing. In the middle of the night, they'd
yep.
climb up and change huge, expensive billboard advertising into something that made, yeah, as you say, made smoking ridiculous.
And I think, you know, all power to Extinction Rebellion and the Greens and the parts of the Labor Party that are trying to get rid of coal and have a greener future. You know, there's lots of great people doing lots of great things, and there's lots of poets and artists doing great things along these lines. But one of the most important weapons we have is humour and ridicule and satire. And those things are really important. And I'm just waiting to see. I know there has been a bit of guerrilla action with those people who are putting up ads in the
yes.
bus shelters and things.
Yes.
I can't remember who the person was who's doing
yes.
that, but that's fantastic. And we need more of that, yeah.
Very creative in the theatre and the disco flash mobs that they've had recently in the inner city. I kind of figure that, you know, when people think, oh, we can't change, I think if you can train a culture to pick up dog poo,
yeah, absolutely.
And take it home.
That's it. I mean,
I think you can do anything. You know,
think about that. Taking the counter message where people expect the unremarkable message, the same old story to be, you know, taking the news story there to confront people where they don't expect to be confronted and make them laugh and make them see how ridiculous it is that we are digging up coal in this day and age and pouring more crap into the atmosphere when the house is on fire. I mean, yeah. 2,000 people's houses on fire, gone, literally, the last 2 months. I mean, wake up. If this doesn't wake people up, what will?
Not to mention all the houses of the wildlife that have gone up in smoke.
And yet these right-wing forces who deride the idea of being woke. Being woke is a wonderful thing. This is what we need to work on. Let's all be woke.
Let's embrace being woke. Okay, I'm going to get you to read from the Daily Kit, a poem that I think you just wrote a day or two ago, Eternal Lines.
Oh, okay. So this is a more philosophical piece that's it's towards a collection of notes about the problem of time, which is in turn for another manuscript I'm working on for a book called God's Bother, which the idea of it's basically a collection of ideas that would bother God or gods. Anyway, so Eternal Lines. So these are very drafty notes. More and more gone to it, as if had helped themselves, now can't be helped. It's how time's undiscovered. Pick up speed, take thunder, hear the blooms. You think to draw them, but retreat. All on country there, a tonal pulse to which I call, storms of cloud or simply dark, souls have been sold for more, less in odd cases, cough and it's over, take ship, time's unattended, like a dream and come to me, angels will, so tidings born, some days deep in my words, I have missed it, gone without, I think there are numbers we guess, take rain, a measured thing, world at a time, and pipe it from the tank. Call kingdom if you must. Pointed healing towards all wounds, a muttering of peace. It has a signature, if rarely read. How lightning struck me gone. And then the second part of that was, it has come. For instance, so much lost tonight. Speak under itch and influence, the river run without the fish. Consider a distance till Christmas, all its implements are torture. Comes as a singularity where words went, I am too, and brief though fraught, a sea of bobs and bits. There is a shutter capture click, none keep up with me. You think you've filled a page with it, but light still stutters through. Thing sung towards, not hit. We think we're pissing out of the tent, but the truth still is calligraph fates and likewise furies, harpies, goblins of the hob, in lapidary letters. Please tell me what remains. Some will say mere technique. Think always a way around. It's made from the career. Little bird told me so.
Thank you very much, Kit Callan, for your time. And we can continue the conversation at the Daily Kit.
We will.
And so can our listeners, Climactic people, get in there and check it out. So the Daily Kit is thedailykitkellan.blogspot.com. And you can also find more about Kit and his books and his paintings at kitkellan.com. That's kitkellen.com, and we'll put all that in the show notes and a few other things. And thank you again, and thank you for listening. You're on Climactic.
Thanks, Beth. It's been a pleasure.
And go make some art.
And a cup of tea, I think.
And a cup of tea at the same time.
Uru.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Climactic, the flagship podcast of the Climactic Collective, a podcast network dedicated to lifting the voices of the climate community. You can find out more about the people behind Climactic and all the shows we produce at climactic.fm. We are a social enterprise podcast network, and we greatly appreciate your support. You can find a link to our Pozible where you can support us directly in the show notes of this episode or from our website. Thank you for listening, and from the whole Climactic Collective, keep up the great work and take care of each other in these climactic times.